You're listening to Radio Golf Show. Ladies and gentlemen, friends and a few enemies, from Germany, it's Radio Golf Show. Welcome to the program. I am your host. My name is Frank Forster. This is not a promo. This is the actual show. The many layers and facets of the game are what make golf what it is, the game. Peeling back one of these layers, I've always enjoyed the impact that names and nicknames of players have on the game. We have the King, the Golden Bear, the Hawk, the Walrus, the Big Easy, Slamming Sam, Boom Boom, Babe, Big Mama, the Merry Mix, Champagne Tony, one of my favorites, and of course, Golf Show All-Star Gentle Ben. And then came the ones who, like Cher and Prince and Madonna, needed only one name, Savvy and Tiger. And then the ones that went by their initials, JT and DJ. In Germany, we have a guy who is on the European tour now. We call him Freddie, I Shot the Sheriff. Not many people know him, but he's out there. My favorite name on tour has always been Johnny Vegas from Venezuela, I think, or Ecuador, wherever he's from. I don't even know where he's from. The name's so cool. Until the great Chris Berman of ESPN, just a couple of weeks ago, came up with Killing Me Softly with his song. I thought that was fantastic. Tonight, we are also throwing our hat in the name ring with none other than Roderick Bastard. Roderick, many thanks for spending time with us. We are glad you are here. How are you, sir?
Oh, it's good to be with you and a privilege to be on your show. So I'm really looking forward to having a chat. Everything's good. I'm down in the south of Spain, so there are worse places to be, even though it's a little bit hot at the moment.
Very good. Let's kick it off with the question on everybody's lips. Any relation to Sir Roderick Stewart?
No, not at all. Not at all. It's an interesting one with the name. You know, it opens lots of doors. When I was younger, it was an embarrassment, something to be avoided. But since then, I've embraced it, and it gets you into a lot of very quick conversations, very quick friends, first name basis with all my professors in university.
There you go.
And I grew up playing tennis, so I spent a lot of time giving umpires nightmares in tennis matches in stadiums when they had to say advantage, Mr. Bastard, or game, Mr. Bastard. So, yeah, I'm used to it.
Game, set, and match. Very cool. Well, I'm glad we got that nasty rumor about Rod Stewart out of there. But, you know, many people don't know that his name is Roderick, too. I find that. And I learned that his name is Roderick Stewart from the great Dame Edna. So you never know how these things happen. But let's get back to the more informational Radio Golf Show. The entertaining side of us is too often misunderstood. For those of you who enjoy our material regularly, you very well know that we work with neither a net nor a script. And of all the mediocre moderators out there, I say M more than any of them. Sir Roderick and I may talk today technique, equipment fitting, putting, chipping, golf ball rollback, strategy, course setup, design, senior open, legend tour, Q school, or we may not. Roderick, you may not only occasionally play for money on the tours, you're also a teacher of the game and a manager of a resort. You're joining us today from Spain, as you said. Tell us what's going on down there. How long have you been there and in what capacity?
Yeah, I've been had the privilege to be at a very nice club down in Marbella. It's the Marbella Club Golf Resort. I've been here 22 years, if you can believe that, in the capacity of manager of the urbanization, the golf course. We have an equestrian center. So I have plenty of time to be busy and to be occupied. I am very lucky to have a very nice membership, very good company to work for. And I'm still passionate about playing the game. So my day today is being around the amateurs, running the course, making sure everything runs smoothly, looking after the horses, which for the owners of the horses are their babies, so we have to take care of them. And then I still try and sneak in a few holes, hit a few putts, do a bit of chipping, and it's mostly fun to get out and compete. And my favorite thing is to take on these young guys that are on the challenge tour and that, and give them a hiding and teach them a lesson or two.
But there you go. This Marbella Golf Club, is it a resort where I can go and rent a room, or is it a private club, or how can I imagine that?
No, so the Marbella Club Golf Resort is a private urbanization in the hills of Benavís in Marbella, but we're a part of a big hotel group, and our main hotel is the Marbella Club Hotel, which has been on the coast of Marbella and has been a stalwart of Marbella for 50 years. So it's been there a long time. We're part of the same group. They also have the Puente Romano. They have some hotels in skiing up in Sierra Nevada, around the world. So very lucky to be attached to a top quality, high level hotel group, and we're on the golfing side of it. We're about 20 minutes away from the middle of Marbella. So we're in the Spanish countryside. You feel like you're in the peace and quiet of the mountains. 15 minutes, you can be on the beach. Hour and a half, hour and 45 minutes, you can be skiing.
There you
So
go.
it's a special place.
There you go. Can you tell us a little bit about the golf course? What kind of course? Who designed it? Maybe and maybe that's a way to get into one of the topics of golf course design.
Yeah, the golf course was designed. We opened in 99, and it was designed by legendary Ryder Cup player Dave Thomas. The course he originally designed in about 95, 96. Then the project was stopped. And when our company got involved in 98, 99, the routing was done. A lot of the earth movement was done. And we just had to basically do the shaping and and create the golf course. The golf course is in the mountains, so it's spectacular views. Very individual holes. You'll find not really many holes running next to each other. So up and down the valleys and along the tops. And even though it's a mountain golf course, I would say of the mountainous courses down here, it's by far the most playable. You have the pretty views and the spectacular nature of the course, but it's very, very playable.
The vegetation must be awesome as well, no?
Yeah, it's very natural. We have houses around the urbanization, but the minimum plot size is about 6,500 square meters. So there's no apartments, no high density building. So you really, really have a feel for being in the Spanish countryside. And on multiple views, you have views of Gibraltar, North Africa. So it's a very spectacular place to play. We also have 12-minute start times. We don't really not interested in putting 150 people a day on the course. A busy day for us is 50 or 60 players, and that's what we want. We want people to have a nice time and enjoy their golf, not feel too much pressure. You want to stop after 9 holes and have a bite to eat on the terrace, then that's fine. And that's really the philosophy of the whole thing.
Well, I think that's the secret of any successful resort, that in the beginning there was golf, and then everything else layers on top of it, that it's an experience. Are most of the villas on the golf course on the slice side, on the right side of the fairways? I know a lot of architects.
Some are on the right side, some are on the good side, the left side, but most of them don't even come into play. You see them, and I think it adds to the golf course, but you don't feel crowded in any way. A lot of the other courses down here, you feel like you're bouncing it off neighbor 57's dining room table to get it onto the green, and that's not the situation here.
Do you have a personal interest in golf course architecture? Is that something you've, I mean, even us who are just amateur hackers, everybody is, has once designed a hole on a napkin at in a bar or something like that. And it has become the sexy profession in the golf industry, taking over from the golf pro. Everybody now wants to be a golf course architect all of a sudden.
I love it. Having played golf all around the world, different courses in America and the UK, competitively, so it's always a passion for every golfer to think, oh, what would I do? What would I change? What did I do? And I had an opportunity about 8 or 9 years ago when we built our second golf course here. It's called El Higueral, and it's a 9-hole golf course at the moment. It will be an 18-hole golf course. And I had the opportunity to design this course. So it was an absolute dream come true. The original design was a Dave Thomas design, and then we acquired extra land and we passed it along to his son. And he said, no, the other land doesn't really work or something like that. And I said to my boss, no, I think it is. You can do it this way. You can go around here and go around there. Green could be here. We walked the course and then we ended up building it. So it's just amazing to have created something along with the greenkeepers because we did it all together. To lay something out on paper, see it come to life, and then have people play and enjoy it. And it will be there forever. And to be honest, it's something I'm very, very proud of. And every time I play it, I enjoy it. People haven't given me any negative comments, but that's to
There you
me.
go.
But in general, a lot of people enjoy it. I think the secret to this course was to make it interesting enough to be exciting to play. So there's some lakes and some water and stuff. But the idea was not to beat the golfer up. It was not to put high lips on the bunkers and deep bunkers and very narrow. Because at the end of the day, the majority of our golfers, you know, they're not Rory McIlroy. They're not Dustin Johnson. They're people that spend their hard-earned money, really enjoy the game. They want to come on holiday and they don't want to play on a driving range, but they want to play on something that they can have some fun at and enjoy the game. And in this situation, it's very good. And the interesting thing is the 9 holes are the central nine. So the 18 is designed, and in the future, we'll get to building the rest of it. And it's on a nice piece of land, pretty flat, easy to walk. So all of those things are nice down here in Spain, where everything is normally very mountainous and very hilly and very difficult.
Right, and that's also, you said how far from where you are?
Yeah, that's 10 minutes away from
Minutes
me.
away. Okay,
So
so
actually on the way here, it's an independent golf club. We run them separately. And like I said, at the moment, it's only 9 holes, but it's very close by.
You said you've played golf all over the world, and I've played not all over the world, but I've played in three or four continents. Well, everything,
That's all over the world.
well, except Australia, where Royal Melbourne is still on the top of my bucket list. But
Oh, absolutely.
surely you've heard of the rebuilding of Lido that Tom Doak undertook in Wyoming, where he recreated the famous Lido course from Long Island and just put it in the middle of Wisconsin. Some I don't know who paid for it. What do you
But I
think?
mean, all the stuff that Tom Doak and all of the guys and Coren Crenshaw, I mean, they're making some amazing things now. Absolutely amazing things. Visually stunning, very natural, taking into account maintenance, making it a little bit more sustainable, making it a bit more rugged. And I think that's only good for the future. I know that the customer down here, you know, they're used to Augusta and they think that every golf course needs to be all green, all immaculate, not a grade, very soft, very receptive. And I think that's changing. We have obviously a very big drought situation this winter in Spain. We all use recycled water that we water the golf courses with, which has its own things. But the use of water now in the world needs to be reduced. And I think the education of the client needs to change a little bit, and they need to be willing to see a few dry patches, have a few hard bounces, and have a few different colors on the golf course. Not always bright green is the most beautiful color. And those guys are doing amazing designs.
Yeah, it you're absolutely right. I agree with you. But this Lido project is to me very interesting. Copying a course or rebuilding a course, somewhere else than it was. I don't never really heard of that. I mean, I played the Tour 18 golf course in the Woodlands in Texas, where they have 18 famous holes from different, starts off with number 18 from Harbor Town, and Amen Corner is there, and then just copying the holes. Anyways, the sustainability and the water is a big issue here, obviously, as well. We have tens of thousands of football fields and tennis courts that are watered with drinking water in Germany, whereas from our 600, 700, 800 golf courses, only maybe 10 or 20 are watered with drinking water, and we take all the heat for it because it's supposedly the sport for the rich pretty boys. Anyways, looking at us, you know, that should be enough for all those critics that it's a sport for pretty boys. Let's get to another topic that's interesting to me. And it's my show, so I can, you know, I pick the topics. I mean, we pick the topics, not the listeners. Equipment fitting, because, you know, I started playing in the early 80s. We bought stuff off the rack. I'm sure you remember that. We had, you know, the S300, the S400, and we just bought whatever was there. There was no track, man. You couldn't even hit it into a net, really. Talk to us about equipment testing from a golf pro's perspective. As a layman in that topic, I think, and we've had a guy on here who distributes the high-end Japanese golf clubs. He makes his money by selling these high-end, super expensive Japanese club heads. And he came on here and he said, it doesn't really matter what's dangling at the end. It's the thing that you have in your hand, the shaft, that's the most important. But let's, you and me, talk a little bit maybe about lie angle, shaft flex, length of the club and that kind of thing. I know enough that a too upright lie angle makes the ball go left and a too flat lie angle makes it go right, for example.
Fitting's a fascinating thing because we have all this technology now. You have gears, you have TrackMan, you have FlightScope, GC Quad, you put the dots on the face and you see everything and you measure everything. And then you give two players two clubs, they're pretty much the same. They have one good and one bad. So even though we know so much, I think fitting is still a bit of a voodoo dark art to get it 100% right. I agree with you. I think there are certain keys, in my opinion, that are very important. And lie is definitely one of them. I've seen in my experience a half a degree adjustment in lie make a big difference to a player, to a shot shape. Obviously for a slightly better player, but even the amateur player, the most important thing we need to get them doing is trying to hit the club, the ball in the middle of the club. Center contact is the most important thing. Obviously you want to swing the club as fast as you can, but if we can set the club up in a right way that the shaft flexes the right way, the lie is correct, we hit the ball in the middle of the club, we're going to get the amateur to have the most fun and have the best result. For me, lie comes into that a lot. Length is a very important one, I think, for center contact as well, and a little bit weight. And with weight, you can talk about shaft weight and you can talk about swing weight. Mm-hmm. Both of those, I think, are important. In my opinion, driver length, they're all too long for 90% of the amateurs that are playing. All the drivers are too long and all the clubs are too upright. Mm-hmm. So I would say most people would be better off going a little flatter to get better contact. And with their driver, 3-wood, 5-wood, definitely half an inch shorter to an inch shorter. You're not going to lose any distance. You're going to hit it more in the middle and you're going to have much, much, much more control. You know, the driver length on tour used to be 44. It's now maybe 44 and a half inches, 45. Every time they sell an amateur something in the shop, it's 46, 47. And you just cannot control that long a shot and hit the ball in the middle. So
Excuse me. Driver shafts for amateurs are 2.5 inches, 2 to 2.5 inches longer than what they use on tour?
Yeah, pretty much. Depends on the player, but a lot of them, even if we don't say two, we say 1.5.
Right.
And
still,
1.5 is too long. And I reckon most of the people, which is why what's the biggest trend at the moment in golf? Mini drivers.
Yeah.
Okay. Mini drivers is a hot topic. Why? Because it's got a 3-wood shaft in it.
Yeah.
So you've got a 3-wood shaft with a big head. And that's what people like hitting. You know, at the end of the day, a lot of people like their 3-wood, but the 3-wood head is small. So let's build some drivers that have a 44 and a half inch shaft or 45 inch shaft.
Right.
Get some loft on it, 10 and a half, 11 degrees. Get people off the tee because you can talk about putting as much as you like. But if you're not consistently off the tee and in play, doesn't matter what you do after that.
Exactly. I'm not a believer in drive for show, putt for dough at all. Number one, because I'm a horrible putter. But when you and I started playing, we got a set of clubs. We didn't get a new set of clubs every year, every season, but we got a set of clubs and we went to the range and we figured out how the damn things worked and kind of built our swings around that. Then of course you can say, okay, if the club doesn't really fit you, that's why you have a terrible swing, because you have to figure out a way how to get the club on the ball. Does it make sense for somebody who's a, I don't know, 25, 30 handicap playing for a couple of years to get fitted if he doesn't have a repeatable swing?
Yeah, I think it's a different one. I think it's a difficult one, but I would say yes. I think the years of having to adjust to your equipment, I think are gone. I don't think we're in that situation
Yeah.
anymore. I think you can adjust them to help. So even if you're a 25, 30 handicap, at least get something that's close to the right flex. Because even if you don't hit the ball every time, you know how fast you swing it. You can measure that. You get something the right length, and you can do that with static measurements, wrist to floor and posture and that kind of stuff, and get something with a nice, easy club head, nice loft. So I think to a certain extent you can. You're not going to go into the nitty-gritty of dynamic loft and angles of attack and turf interaction and sole grinds and all of this at a 25, 30 handicap. But I think we need to make this game as easy as possible for everyone that plays. The future of our game is to have more and more people have fun. And we've got to make it as easy as possible. We need nice big club heads, nice easy shots to hit, relatively short courses. Let's the guys making some pars and some bogeys and some double bogeys. And then we can keep this game growing and people having fun.
Right. I totally agree with you. And you just mentioned the future of the game. The German Golf Federation just came out with a statistic that between 2010 and 2023, the amount of, and Germany is the country in Europe with the most golfers. I think we have 700,000, even more than Britain. But between 2010 and 2023, the number of our junior golfers under 18 went from 52,881 in 2010 to 42,859 in 2023. That's 19% less in a matter of 13 years. And the German Federation presents this statistic. It's time to do something about it. I don't know what they did for the last 13 years, but obviously they haven't done anything. How do you grow the game down in Spain?
I tell you what, that's a scary, scary, scary stat, and that's worrying. And I would say that Germany has always been in the forefront of growing and having growth and everything like that. How do you grow the game? It's very difficult. The thing is with the kids now, in general, in all sports, there's too many distractions. You know, they're on their phone, they're seeing the TikToks and the YouTubes and everything like that, which is fine, but they want this instant gratification. They want to be good at things straight away. And unfortunately, you're not going to be very good at golf in the beginning. It's a very difficult game. It's very demanding. The margins for error are tiny. So you get the kids that try and they find it difficult. Maybe they're not welcome at the club. Maybe they have to play only on the afternoons because they're not allowed on the course because they're the kids. Maybe the members of the club disapprove of them being on the golf course, and that those are all things that we're fighting against. And at the end of the day, you can get a soccer ball and kick it around and have some fun with your friends, and you can be pretty good at it quite easy. So I think the difficult nature of learning how to play golf is maybe an impediment of people starting and also people continuing. But there are amazing programs. We don't have a big junior section here. Locally in Benavís, the town, the municipal has a golf school there. Down the coast, in a course called La Cañada, they have a brilliant kid section. And one of the guys that's helped me a little bit with my swing is a guy called James Hong. He's a great coach in New York, and he has an amazing kid section that are growing, and they're competitive beginners and everything. It's about exposing them to the game as early as possible, making them as welcome as possible, and making it as easy as possible. How do you make the game easier? That's a difficult one. And then we lead into the equipment and the ball rollback and all of this. That's a different subject, but it's difficult to keep them motivated when they're topping it and slicing it and shanking it, and the courses are too difficult. So they get disheartened and they might stop, and that's the difficult thing.
Well, in Spain, it's got to be even more difficult if you have Spain winning the European Championship and Alcaraz winning Wimbledon on the same day to get kids excited about golf. But we'll keep
fighting. Yeah, Seve didn't do a bad job.
Yeah.
And Jose Maria has always been an amazing ambassador for golf in Spain. John's obviously trying to do what he's doing. I'm not sure how much of an effect, but he has a massive influence, especially in the north of Spain.
Right.
And there's a huge element that of junior golf that play at a very high level. But it's those we always look at the elite junior, and it's not necessarily about the elite junior. We want the junior that's going to turn into the 15 handicap, 25-year-old member that's going to turn into the 10 handicap, 35-year-old member.
Who
and
brings
they're going
his kids
to play
one
all
day?
Of their life. Those are the ones that we need. I don't need another John Ram.
Yeah,
exactly. I need 100,000, 15 handicap.
Yeah. Do you think golf at the Olympics is a good thing there to help it grow? I mean, I personally love it. I think they could change the format up a little bit with some teams and mix stuff, but I think it's wonderful.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Olympics reaches an audience that maybe doesn't normally watch golf, doesn't watch a normal competition. I know with my Olympic consumption, I was watching sports that I wouldn't normally be exposed to. And I think that's golf is fantastic. And I think it's good. I just have a problem with the pros. You know, it's like I don't see Steph Curry as an Olympian. You know, I'm not sure that I see John Rahm as an Olympian. I suppose for my age group, it was more the amateurs got the opportunities to play that and represent their country. And I understand it's changed, but I think it's great. And you see the passion of Novak winning the Olympic medal. He's really, really into it. And even Justin Rose, ever since he won, he's been massively proud of winning it. So I think anything that exposes the world to the game of golf has to be a good thing.
I think it might be time to consider like an old Olympics for the amateurs, and one where they allow where you must take drugs. You're tested to check if you have taken enough steroids. That would be a cool Olympics too.
I totally agree. I always thought that cycling should be that way.
Exactly.
An illegal division. We don't test anyone. Just do what you want.
Let's close up the club fitting. Obviously, you would recommend a full bag club fitting, but if I had the choice of an iron fitting, a driver fitting, a wedge fitting, or a putter fitting, where would you send me? Not knowing my game.
I would still say driver.
Driver.
I would still say driver. I think driver should be the easiest club to play in the bag. It should be.
Mm-hmm.
It's the biggest head. You hit it a lot, and it makes a massive difference to your score. If you can hit a driver in the fairway, and you can hit it 15 meters longer, it makes every single hole you play with that club on much easier. It makes the second shot easier. It makes you more likely to do it. If you can't get off the tee and you're hitting it out of bounds and you're hitting it in the hazard, we're not getting to the putter or the chipping or even the irons. Obviously, you want to have everything, but I really think driver is very important, especially for the amateur player.
Yeah. All right. I have a driver that's got to be 15, 16 years old with an X shaft.
you're trying to make the game harder for yourself.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Plus,
if you like to challenge yourself, no problem then.
At my age, you get shorter a little bit, so now I got this big ass thing with the graphite design X shaft that I could hit when I was, 40. And I'm still using it. And every once in a while I catch one, but it's like 1 out of 20.
Yeah, I mean, all of these 10 yards longer that we hear every year for the last 16 years, and none of us are hitting it 400 yards. But, something like that, if your driver was that old, I would say you could probably pick up 15 meters with a new driver, and 15 meters, maybe less stressful, easier on the body, nice and high and more forgiving for sure. So it might give you a bit more fun if you had a new driver.
There you go. I'm really bad at putting. Let's talk putting. And as a playing pro as well, we had Jeff Mangum on a couple of times on the show from the Putting Zone, who talks about the four skills of putting: touch, stroke, read, and aim. Not in that order, obviously, and of course we've had Ben Crenshaw on, Gentle Ben, and we talked about how he couldn't understand why what they're doing now, that they're straddling the line. Don't they have eyes? What's going on there? Where are you on the putting side? I mean, I have, and let me just, I talk way too much about myself, but 18 holes, let's say I have 36 putts, which would be good for me. I have 36 different grips, 36 different ball positions. I got no idea what I'm doing. Let's talk about touch, stroke, read, and aim. Are those the four skills necessary to become a decent putter?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, Jeff Mangan's an absolute genius. He's a genius savant, way more intelligent, way more knowledgeable than me. Ben Crenshaw's an absolute legend of the game. And I totally agree with Jeff on the four fundamentals, for sure, 100%. And I think one of the hardest ones to do and to practice is the green reading, and there's more and more people that are working on that side of it, how to visualize the break, how to see the break, how to practice the break of the putts, which is very difficult because once you've hit one putt on a green, in theory, you've kind of got an idea of how the ball's going to roll. So any practice you do after that, you have a little bit of a clue there. But one thing I would say is, if you look at the dynamics of the putting stroke and how we put energy on the ball, anyone who looks at Ben Crenshaw's putting stroke has got a massive key into how to putt well. Okay. Ben Crenshaw's backstroke is probably three times longer than his follow through. Okay. And this is something that we've lost 15 years ago, 20 years ago. The follow through needs to be longer, needs to be accelerating, short backstroke, long follow through. These things are not correct. That's not a good way to generate speed. Now, more and more guys, Bruce Rearick in America, all of the putting guys, Brad Faxon, the backswing needs to be long enough that I can put the putter on the ball without an excessive acceleration. So the problem with the amateurs, you see them, they take the putter back the same distance, whether it's 3 meters or 30 meters, and then try and over-accelerate and get it through. If we could get more backstrokes into it and a little bit shorter follow through, that little contact with the ball, that little strike on the ball gives the ball enough energy to maintain its line, and we're getting much better distance control. When you have this short backstroke and over-acceleration, one's short, one's long, a lot of the time, you have no idea how hard you're going to hit it. And of all those skills that we've talked about, distance control is the king. The king, the king, the king. The start line of the putt is very important on putts, let's say between 50 centimeters and 2 meters. Outside that, you're probably not going to make it anyway. So let's make sure that we have the right speed and we're two putting. And like you said, if you actually hit 18 greens and two putted every green, you'd be a very, very good putter. And that's the other thing is the amateur has a very, very poor perception of what's a good putt. And basically, outside 2 meters, if you can two putt, you're a very good putter. And we get obsessed with working on the line. We get obsessed with working on the path of our stroke. And why? Because we can see it. And at the end of the day, speed generation, energy generation, and is the most important thing. And face control, face control. Where's the face pointing at impact? Just like when we hit a driver, just like when we hit an iron, is the face pointing to the right? Is the face pointing to the left? Or is the face pointing at the hole? And that for me is the key to putting.
When I see a 30 handicap straddling the line of a 3 foot putt, I get physically ill. I have no idea what they're doing either, but
Yeah, the aim point revolution is an interesting one. Some people hate it, some people love it. I've done the courses, I know how to do it. I'm not very good at feeling it with my feet. I know it works, but I just struggle to trust what I feel. Most of the time I stand there and it just feels straight. It feels level unless I'm on a massive slope. But if I'm on a massive slope, I can see it's a massive slope anyway. So yeah,
Exactly.
that's difficult. But one of my favorite things to do is literally just put a ball down and go 2 meters, 3 meters in front of the ball and just put a ball marker down and just get used to putting and rolling the ball over that ball marker. And then when you go and play, what you can do is put the ball marker, read the putt, put the ball marker down 2 or 3 meters in front of the ball, or even 1 meter if it's a short putt, where you think you have to roll the ball, and hit the putt over the ball marker. And it's a very good way to see, am I seeing the break? Am I not seeing the break? Maybe I'm seeing the break, but I've hit it way too hard and it hasn't broken. Maybe I've rolled it over the ball marker and I've hit it too soft and it's way low. So it's very simple, very low tech, but it's something that if we did in a diligent way every time we played, put a ball marker down, roll some putts over the ball marker, we'd all get better.
But you mentioned the long backstroke and the short follow-through. I mean, as Isawa Aoki comes to mind immediately, but also Jack Nicklaus, one of the greatest putters in the history of the game. I've never seen anybody teach Jack Nicklaus's putting stroke.
No, I know he
Amazing.
was always very hunched over, right
And
shoulder very low,
yeah,
eyes
nobody
behind,
teaches that.
feet a little bit open, but it what, teaching and technique, and we just get lost, don't we? We go through a stage where you have to have your back perfectly straight. You have to be perpendicular to the line. We can't be open, we can't be closed, we can't, and at the end of the day, we should be doing whatever we need to do to get the ball in the hole. And even the same thing to hit a driver, hit an iron shot. If I need to be a little bit open or a little bit closed, or have my head a little bit behind, or have my eyes inside the ball, then go ahead and do it. As long as you can start it on that line and roll it over that ball mark or roll it over that target, then you can putt.
There you go. One of our younger all-stars, Albert Hansson from Sweden, just came back from Hazeltine, where he played in the U.S. Amateur tournament, where you have to perform over 36 holes of stroke play in order to get to the main event, the match play. Albert missed by a couple of shots. Unfortunately, he's a really good kid, but he, I don't know, he played the boys' amateur at Carnoustie, I believe it was, 36 holes against his roommate, and it was fantastic golf. Anyways, currently ongoing on the big dance tour are the FedEx playoffs, also where you go from I don't know 120 in the first event down to 50 down to 30, an event likened by current US Ryder Cup captain Keegan Bradley as having the tenseness of a Q school event. Now, you've played the Legends Tour Q school qualifying stages. I believe you played, let me see, I actually looked it up. In Turkey, you shot 143, one under over the first 36, tying for first. And then you played the final stage, which is over 72 holes, right?
Yep.
Yeah, you played 54 holes in three over, just missing out on the last round. Can you talk us through can you talk us through that experience? I mean, what it's like when you have guys, I mean, and when you have, the best golfers in the world talking, it's like a Q school, which is the most tense event in the world. How did you deal with that? With the pressure, with the stress. I mean, it must be just a big pot of stress that you're stirring there.
Yeah, I mean, it's a fascinating thing because I've played European Tour qualifying as well, Q schools, when I was younger. And then I actually played Champions Tour qualifying the last couple of years. I got to the finals there as well. And it's very, very nice of Mr. Bradley to say that the FedEx Cup is like the Q school. But those guys in the FedEx Cup have a lot of zeros in their bank accounts already when they're getting into the FedEx Cup. So it's nothing like a Q school. The Q school is something where you know that if in those 4 rounds you don't play your best golf, those 4 rounds of the year, the rest of the year, you do not play any golf. You do not play any competitions. So, it's nothing like the FedEx Cup. Those guys have got lots of money in there. Now, if you lose your card and then they're going back to a Q school, then Q school's Q school. But FedEx Cup playoffs, I don't see that kind of pressure for them at all. What I would say about all of the Q schools is that the depth of quality of player that we have at the top level, whether you're playing Legends Tour in Europe, Champions Tour in America, whether you're playing the young guys playing Challenge Tour, the young guys on the Alps Tour, any kind of professional tour, there is a massive depth of talent and a depth of field, and all the guys are trying to play and get to the top. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you say we, in Turkey, we started with 140, 150, then the final 70 or 80 guys, and we're playing for five cards, for mm-hmm. five spots.
Yep.
You can say, oh, well, there's, you know, there's only 80 players. But of those 80 players, these guys are the best. They've played on the European Tour when they were younger. They've played competitive golf all their lives. And you know that 20 or 25 of them are going to be playing really well. So you've still got to get past 20 of them or 22 of them to play.
To make
so the pressure's high. Like I said, if you make a mistake, you're not going anywhere. You're not playing in anything. And that can be in the first round, the second round, the third round. I mean, I've had experiences in the Q School where you stand over a shot, maybe you're a little bit in the trees, and you have to say, I hit a five iron left of a tree over a lake and cut it back onto the green. And you know, standing over that shot, if I miss this shot, Q School's finished. You know, it's not like tennis. We talk about tennis, double fault, lose the first set, off you go. But you're standing over a shot and you think, if I don't pull this shot off, if it doesn't cut and I hit it in the lake, or if it cuts too much and it hits the tree, this tournament is finished. So I've flown,
can't be thinking
I've paid
that.
My entry fee. I've been, so that's an added pressure at all. And that's, you multiply that by four rounds, you know, all the holes you play, all the qualifying. There's a lot of guys putting a lot of effort in. It's the same as any of the qualifying, you know, qualifying for the Open. We were, you know, talking about the Open. The 130 guys at my qualifying course at downfield for four spots, you know, these are guys from Japan, from Australia, from America, from all over Europe that have got on a flight. They've paid their entry fee. They've traveled. They've played their practice rounds. They've rented cars for four spots, you know, and we're all passionate about it, and we're all happy to be there, and we all want to play, and we want to do our best, but there's only four guys.
Yeah. So is that stress and that pressure really what we play for? I mean, when I play for a beer with my friends, I mean, that's my pressure. But is it the pressure and the fear and the stress what's really exciting about this game?
I think you have to like it. I know it's strange, but I think you have to like it. And you have to like being on the course. You have to like the people watching you. You have to like getting into a stressful situation and A, seeing, can I handle it? And then B, you know, when you do handle it and you hit a great shot, and I've hit some terrible shots under pressure, but when you do hit a great shot and you pull it off, the feeling's unbelievable. You know, the feeling's unbelievable. More so than the prize money wears off. It's nice to have the prize money or everything, but to have that pressure where you've looked at your phone and you know you have four holes to play and you're on the qualifying spot. Okay, I have to play the next four holes. I would like to make a birdie to qualify, but I better not make a bogey because I'm not going through. So you've got to enjoy that. And sometimes you rise to those situations and there's no better feeling. And then other times you hit a weak shot and you crumble and then you think, who hit that shot, you know?
Yeah.
And, it was me. Now I've made a double bogey and that's another year out of the window and off we go again.
Yeah. This year you did qualify for the Open. And that gave you a lot of, because of your name, not because of that Roderick name, a lot of notoriety. I remember last year, the 23 Senior Open, I don't recall where it was, but I remember the conditions were horrendous when Alex Chaker won, and we had Michael Johnson on shortly after that, the Swedish guy who finished third or something like that. This year, the Open was at Carnoustie, right? You know, and again, that's the antidote to the perfect Augusta or whatever, you know, all those golf courses that are perfectly manicured. Talk us through your Open experience. Was it your first Open?
Yeah, it was my first Open and my first major. So first of all, the qualifying was very stressful. I managed to tie for the final qualifying spot with two other guys.
Oh.
And so we went into a sudden death playoff and I won the spot at the Open on the fifth playoff hole.
Jesus Christ.
So I made some amazing pars to stay in there, nice birdie. And then I ended up hitting it to about 2 inches from the hole, tap in to win the spot at about 8:45 in the evening in Dundee. Very fairy tale, very emotional, very happy.
Yeah.
Within half an hour, I'm trying to find somewhere to stay. To stay on and take the car back and take your flights and change. So it was amazing. But the year before was Royal Port Call, and
yes.
the conditions there were a nightmare.
Yes.
And we were at Carnoustie, which, you know, I've been, a lot of my friends on tour have spoken about Carnoustie as their favorite course, one of the most challenging, one of the most difficult courses. So like you said about the conditions in Port Call, you qualify and you're very happy. And then you think, oh my God, what have I got myself into? You know, I've now got to play against the best players in the history of the game, one of the hardest links courses you can imagine, and not make a fool of myself. So a lot of it was pleasure and fun, and it was an amazing experience. And then there's a bit of stress that comes with it, and you want to try and do your best.
Yeah.
I enjoyed the experience. I loved it. I played St. Andrews and some other links courses. Carnoustie was a very, very special course. But very, very demanding, and very demanding in a linksy way.
Yeah.
You know, you have these fairway bunkers that you're trying to avoid, but sometimes you just, even with good strategy, you just can't take them out of play, because if you carry one set of bunkers, the ground is so firm and bouncy that you just run into the next set. So sometimes you just have to hit a good shot. You just have to hit it. You have to split the bunkers and hit them through. The difference is they always play the Dunhill links there in winter, and the rough in the Dunhill links is very low. When we played Carnoustie this year, they'd had a very wet spring, and the rough was very high. So you had to hit it very straight, and that was intimidating. You just had a feeling that if you hit a loose shot, you wouldn't find the ball, which you know, I started badly in the first 7 or 8 holes. And then I suddenly realized from my playing partners and even myself, actually, if we did hit it off the fairway, we would find it and you could play. And then I calmed down and I played the next 28 holes really well. And I missed the cut by 2, I think. But I should have made the cut, which would have been amazing in my first major. But it's one of those interesting things how you can get. I honestly wasn't nervous and I wasn't scared of the occasion. I love the occasion. I like being in front of the crowd and everything. That's fine. But you just get a little bit scared of the golf course, and then you just don't make your swing as freely as possible.
Yeah.
You try and guide the ball and you get into trouble. You've got to just let it go and play your game and trust that everything will be okay.
Yeah. So when you go to the range at the Senior Open and you see the guys, the Ryder Cup captains, the major winners, that to you, is a good feeling, and you're like, yeah, this is, I mean, now I have a chance to show myself instead of shitting your pants, basically. That's the way
you've got to enjoy it. I mean, I was in the fitness trailer getting my back sorted out by the beautiful physios. They do such a good job there. And the guy was treating me, and then I looked to my left and there's Mr. Langer on the bed getting stretched out there and talking about the operation on his knee. I looked to the right, there's Rich Beam there.
Yeah.
Rich Beam gets up, Paul McGinley sits down. I walk out, I bump into Retief Goosen.
Yeah.
I go down the stairs, Miguel Angel's hitting balls. I have a chat with Michael Campbell, and I'm like, what am I doing here? You know,
yeah.
I mean, these are all my heroes. You know, I'm talking to Jose Maria Olazabal, watching them hit balls. So the first hour, 2 hours, half a day, you're a tourist and you're just loving everything. And, you know, you think you recognize somebody and well, he's from the TV. So then you have to realize that it's just a golf course. It's just a game. You're good enough to be there. You're good enough to hit the shots. You got to get on and play. And that's the challenge, is to make that switch.
Yeah. What are the requirements to enter the Q School for the Legends Tour? I mean, is there, you have to have, I'm sure you can't go with a 10 handicap. And
no, you have to be obviously a professional golfer.
Uh-huh.
Or you can enter, and I think the entry for the amateurs might be scratch, might be one.
Uh-huh.
But I think it's scratch or better. You can play as an amateur. Obviously, if you got through as an amateur, you would have to turn professional to play on the tour.
Right.
But you're allowed to play the qualifying school as an amateur and compete. Actually, last year I played the first 2 rounds with an amateur.
Okay.
And otherwise, a professional, and you can be a professional from anywhere in the world.
Yeah.
There's no restriction or anything like that.
And it's got to be pretty costly undertaking as well, because you
Yeah,
know.
I mean, it's the dream is always Champions Tour because of the prize money.
Yeah.
So I've done Champions Tour a couple of times, and without even blinking, you're talking about 10 to 12,000 euros to do the qualifying school. Entry fee on Champions Tour is already $3,500 just to enter, flights, accommodation. They moved the European Legends Tour to Turkey 2 years ago. And okay, you have a slightly higher flight, but once you're at the resort in Turkey, we all know how good the resorts are out there. Everything's taken care of. So,
Yeah.
okay, you pay about 1,000 euros entry fee. You're gonna have to pay 1,500 in the hotel. So, you're looking at about 3,000, 3,500 euros to play, with no return. There's only a return for five guys.
Right.
So it's a bit of a risk, but there's a bunch of guys that believe they can do it, deserve that to be there, and some phenomenal players.
And what would a year or a season on the Legends Tour cost?
Yeah, I mean, it depends. I mean, they've probably got about 15 to 18 events. You're looking at European events, you're easily spending 1,000 to 1,500. And now, recently, the tour's had to expand. I couldn't go, but they played in Zambia. They're
Right.
playing in Barbados. They're playing in
Exactly.
Acapulco. And those tournaments just go through the roof. So you're looking at, 2,500, 3,000, 3,500 each tournament,
Looking
depending on how
50
you get
grand.
your flights.
Yeah.
You've got paddies, you've got everything. And the prize money's nice, and the tour's growing, and they're doing a fantastic job of trying to get more events. But those costs are high, and the level's good. And you can't just say, oh, I'm going to show up and finish 20th, because there's some very good players there.
What if I told you there's a guy running around Germany who started playing golf at age 49? Literally for the first time he hit a ball when he was 49, and his goal is to play on the Legends Tour within 4 years, competing with Ryder Cup captains, major winners, and former world number ones. Does he have a shot? It's not me.
Does he have a
Let's
shot? Of
call our
course he has a
friend Tony.
shot. No, of course he has a shot. Why not? At the end of the day, I always say to everyone that golf's like mathematics. You have an answer, okay? And the answer is your score, okay? So at the end of the day, if he can go out and he can walk onto any golf course anywhere around his town in Germany, tee it up off the back tees and shoot 3, 4, 5 under par, he's got a shot. It's
Yeah.
just a number. It's just a number. Now, can you shoot that number under the pressure? That's number plus pressure. That's a whole different thing. But
Yeah.
does he have a shot? Yes, of course he does. And the nice thing with the tour school, and even though it's only five cards, is that if he shows up and he shoots the number and he gets his card, he's out there playing.
After four
There's
years,
an opportunity to get there.
four after 4 years of playing the game.
Yeah, but at the end of the day, you have kids that have gone from nothing to scratch in a year. Again, it just depends. Like I said, it's all about the number. You can't fool yourself in this game. If you go down the road and you tee it up and you shoot 7 over par, and the next day you shoot 5 over par, and the next day you shoot 10 over par, don't go to tour school because you're just going to waste your money.
Maybe this is a good time to talk a little about how you got into the game, because for those of us that have played the game long enough, we know that once you start playing and then you work on getting your handicap down, you reach certain levels. I had a level, I had a level at 10. It took me a while to break through handicap 10. Then I got down to 5. I barely got it through 5. But you have these levels where you are and where you have to start working on different parts of your game. I mean, I know that for me, the secret to getting under 5 was having a variety of shots around the green instead of just having one shot around the green, and I could never do that chipping stuff. How did you experience those levels that you had to break through in order to improve, and what did you do about them?
Yeah, I mean, my journey into golf was an unusual one, to be honest, because I grew up playing tennis. So I was a tennis player all through my junior career, all through everything. I was a tennis player. I never played golf at all. And then I went to University of South Carolina in Florence on a tennis scholarship. And my tennis coach there was a 2-handicap golfer obsessed with golf, obsessed with golf. And so I ended up spending as much time with him on the golf course as I did playing tennis and doing everything with there. And I just got bitten by the bug of golf, playing with him, playing in America, playing all sorts of stuff. And I just played and played and played and played and played and hardly had any lessons. And I was probably a 5 or 6 handicap after 2 or 3 years of university and playing, played at the local country club. Then when I finished there, I actually got the assistant tennis coaching job at the Country Club of South Carolina in Florence. They had 6 tennis courts in the middle of the golf course.
Okay.
And we had a buggy, a golf cart, for the use of the tennis club. So at the end of the day, anytime I had a gap in between my tennis lessons, I'd put my clubs on, jump in there and play 3 or 4 holes. So I was just playing and playing and playing and got down to about scratch there with just by playing.
Yeah.
And then when I came back here, I didn't really have a thought about playing golf. And I played golf with a couple of local guys. And one guy, Stephen Wright, a good friend of mine, he said to me, he said, "Oh, you're wasting your talent. You're wasting your talent. You should be playing. You should be having lessons. You should be getting better." And I went to a couple of pros down here. And just like your friend, 49-year-old, does he have a chance? A couple of people told me, no chance to play professional golf without even seeing me hit a ball.
Mm-hmm.
I had that from 2 local professionals. Never saw me hit a ball. No, forget of it. You'll never be a professional golfer. You'll never be any good. Get into the shop, get into teaching, do whatever you want. And I had one guy who's actually my professional here at the club, Gary Vautier. He was at a local course and I said the same thing to him. And he said, no problem, come. He said, you can pick up the balls in the afternoon. You can do whatever you want. You can help out a bit around here and I'll teach you and I'll help you and I'll do that. And like you said, you go through plateaus in the game all the time. But I never had that progression because it was kind of from there. Then I went to tour school. Then I turned pro and it kind of went one thing after another.
Yeah.
But I can tell you that even now, every 2 months of my current game, I have a plateau. My irons are rubbish. And then the next day, my driving's rubbish and the irons are good. And then I hold everything and then I can't hold anything and then I can't putt. And that's why we love the game. That's
right.
Why we love the game.
Right.
And I'm 52 years old. I've played my first major. Now at 52 years old, I've played when I was growing up, I've always worked. So I've played a few challenge tour events, but I've never played full time. So there's hope for everybody.
Right.
And I still love it. I still watch the YouTube guys and see if I can learn something. And looking at Mark Blackburn talking about ground force reaction. I mean, who knows what he's talking about, but you're out there trying it and playing it and seeing if I can gain 20 yards. Yeah, I just love it. Absolutely fantastic.
Well, Tony will be very happy to hear that. The other look, the clock is running. You've played 3 events so far on the Legends Tour, and I love the fact. I mean, on the European Tour, it's called the Race to Dubai. For the Legends Tour, it's called the Road to Mauritius. We're not racing anywhere at our age anymore. Are you
when you get into the Legends Tour and you hand your card in and there are lots of reading glasses on the desk, you know what tour you're on, you know?
what's in store for you for the rest of the year? Any more tournaments coming up?
No, I don't know. I'm in a situation where obviously I qualified for the Open. The other event I played was I managed to qualify for the Senior PGA, which is
exactly
the second biggest tournament there. Played at Trump, played very well, so got a lot of good points there. I would have got into the tournament in Zambia, but with work, I still have to work. With work, I'd been away for 3 weeks, and it was straight away, and I couldn't miss work, so I missed Zambia. And now the rest of the year, to be honest, I'm in the hands of the sponsors to try and get an invite or something like that,
right,
to try and get into 1 or 2 events for the rest of the year. But it's very difficult. I'm what they call an affiliate member of the tour.
Mm-hmm.
So I joined the tour because of my qualifications in these events. but that doesn't give me a right to enter, and I don't have a ranking or a category on this year's tour.
Right.
So I'm already exempt into the finals of the tour school from what I've done, and I'm just hoping to try and get an invitation to one of the events or two of the events in the rest of the year to try and improve my order of merit. And if I could get into the top 50, top 45 would be amazing. But I'm not sure what I'll be able to play in.
Well, I mean, two of those events, I believe, are in Spain, and the sponsors would be foolish not to invite you, having lived in Spain for 22 years. I mean, come on. I don't know who the sponsors are, but
I don't know who the sponsors are, but it's difficult. You know, I understand that there are a lot of people demanding sponsors invites.
Yeah.
But I'm ready to go anywhere at any time. So if anyone wants to sponsor me, I'll be an honorary German if they want to sponsor me for the German Open.
If I were a sponsor, I'd let you play. Roderick, the time flew by. There's so many things we didn't talk about. Hopefully that's a reason for you to come back one day. You are now an honorary Golf Show All-Star. And we have to thank Brother Burley for making this connection. When I asked him, or when he told me that you guys were friends, I've never, in 150 shows, I've never asked one of my guests, hey, can you hook me up? I've never asked Crenshaw, can you hook me up with Trevino? And I don't do that. and Stuart said it out of his own volition, and I'm glad he did. I'm glad we got to have this chat. I think I told Stuart at some point that I would give my left nut for your open bib.
Oh, well. We probably don't have time, but the open bib is a whole different story. Maybe we'll do that on the next podcast.
I've discussed it with my wife. She's not in favor of that trade, so we're gonna.
I don't think so. I think she's happy with you exactly how you are.
Roderick, listen, thanks very much. Enjoy the rest of the day down in Spain, and we'll see you soon. Hopefully we'll definitely see you at our Roto Fest, where we try to pick the major winners. Maybe Stuart told you about this. Bunch of crazy guys hanging out and just having a good time. I wish you all the best.
Thank you so much for having me on. It's been a pleasure. Lovely chat with you, and thanks for thinking of me.
And if you listeners go down to the south of Spain, look up Roderick down in Malaga and in Marbella. I'm sorry, in
Malaga, Marbella, same thing. Marbella Club Golf Resort.
And I'm sure you'll be able to give visitors good tips.
Absolutely, no problem.
That's it. That's the show, ladies and gentlemen. Goodbye to the Lynx Land.